Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Hopper's showing us a diner that operates all night long, and the Nighthawks are the people that hang out late at night, and they're in there having their coffee.
Curator Judith Barter takes us on a tour of some of the most recognizable American paintings about food. Food cooked up today by Chef Bob Atkins. He presents a lesson in not all that unhealthy deep fat frying. We hear from farmers about the pros and cons of the recent push for cage-free eggs. Harvest Public Media also tries to understand why there aren't enough graduates to fill a bunch of new ag jobs in the U.S. And we spend some time with newbie beekeeper Ellie Sims. She's resigned herself to the fact that her hive just isn't going to make it through the winter. Let's recap what happened in the news this week with Mark Chilla.
The FDA released guidelines for produce imported from around the world to ensure it meets U.S. health and safety standards. As part of the Food Safety Modernization Act from 2010, the set of rules governing produce will help catch issues in the food supply before they occur, instead of after illness develops. The FDA pointed out that 19% of U.S. food supply is imported, including 52% of fresh fruits and 22% of fresh vegetables. The USDA launched a program in 2008 to provide fresh fruits and vegetables to low-income elementary school students during the school day. The Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program is separate from the school lunch program, with annual funding around $176 million. Now, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has introduced a bill to expand the program to include frozen, canned, dried, and pureed fruits and vegetables. The bill also has support from Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin and Indiana Senators Joe Donnelly and Daniel Coates. Both of these states are top producers of canned food. In a release, supporters make a local food argument to include canned food, saying the expansion, quote, accommodates cold weather states where local fruit and vegetable harvests are seasonal, unquote. And Thanksgiving birds are smaller and more expensive this year after the worst outbreak of avian flu in U.S. history wiped out nearly 8 million turkeys. According to a USDA report, per-pound turkey prices are up 21% from last year. Frozen turkey supplies are at the lowest in three decades. But not all retailers are passing those costs on to consumers. Many stores discount turkeys to get shoppers in the door during the holiday, taking a loss to boost sales of side dish items. EarthEats.org. That's where you should go to get more food news like these stories.
And Twitter and Facebook, too. All right, Mark Chilla, see you soon.
Till next time, Annie.
This may be the year of cage-free eggs. Several large food companies and restaurants have announced timelines for phasing out eggs laid in cages. That's pushing some major egg producers to make changes. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, there's more to housing a hen than square inches.
Cage-free eggs could be coming to a breakfast near you.
Hi, thanks for choosing Starbucks. What can we get started for you?
I'd like a sausage and cheddar breakfast sandwich.
Oh, sure. Anything else?
Starbucks says by 2020, all of the eggs it buys will come from suppliers who don't use traditional cages. Instead, the hens will live in more open barns where they can fly, roost, walk, and dust bathe. Burger King, McDonald's, Kellogg's, and the food service giant Sodexo all have made similar announcements. We're talking major market share. So, in response, one of the nation's largest egg producers said this fall it would shift all of its millions of chickens to cage-free barns.
We believe there is going to be a future need and an increasing future need for cage-free.
Jonathan Spurway is a vice president of Iowa-based Rembrandt Foods. Mass production of eggs makes them cheap and ubiquitous. Radically changing how the hens live is costly and cumbersome.
We recognize the industry is changing. We want to be part of that, and we want to actually lead that change from a supply point of view.
Most hens today live in cages with about 80 inches of space per bird. Animal welfare groups and a new California law have pushed egg farmers away from that. And now, the shift to cage-free by a big egg company like Rembrandt shows that the industry is listening. Josh Balk of the Humane Society of the United States says he applauds the move, even if he'd like companies to do even more for hens.
Most don't have outdoor access, and the flocks are still too large, but it's a dramatic improvement over being confined in a small cage for their entire lives.
But cage-free has its critics. Ken Clippen of the National Association of Egg Farmers represents about 300 smaller egg producers.
It basically takes the other 92% of all farmers producing eggs and throws them under the bus.
Aside from being much more expensive for producers, Clippen contends that cage-free is less humane. That's because chickens establish a literal pecking order. In traditional cages with groups of 6 or 8 birds, the pecking is dispensed with quickly.
Now, when you compare that to cage-free systems, where there are several thousand chickens loose on the floor, you can imagine how henpecked that lower chicken on that order is.
Clippen has some research on his side.
Or 60. So the conventional, actually in this case, got 6 birds in it.
Just 6?
6 birds.
Okay.
And then the enriched colony, the EC enriched colony has 60 birds in it.
Iowa State University professor Hongwei Shin has compared 3 housing systems, traditional cages, cage-free barns, and a sort of compromise called enriched colonies. In those, hens live in groups of about 60 birds. While cage-free housing allows hens more natural behaviors, Shin has found more birds die in a cage-free setting.
That mortality primarily from some cannibalism.
Yeah, he said cannibalism.
From some mechanical injuries. So as birds move from place to place, probably get injured.
Shin says consumers might also care about differences in worker safety and environmental impact. Cage-free doesn't fare as well there. But as the industry pours resources into cage-free systems, Shin says better management may improve some of those areas.
Basically, the conclusion is that each system has its pros and cons.
Shin says the egg industry can diversify to meet fickle consumer demands here in the United States. But with persistent concerns over food prices and sustainability of the industry, he doesn't expect cage-free eggs to take off worldwide.
A tall chai tea latte, you said?
Yes.
Okay, anything else?
That's it.
All right, 7:38.
Global brands Starbucks and McDonald's are only promising cage-free breakfast sandwiches in their North American stores.
All right, here's that for you. Have a great day. Thank you.
Bon appetit. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Last week, we had a story about how one small art scene used the farm share model to grow its art community. Today, we have a conversation about artists throughout history finding inspiration in American foodways. Judith Barter is the Field McCormick Chair and Curator of American Art at the Art Institute of Chicago. In 2013, she curated the exhibition Art and Appetite, American Painting, Culture, and Cuisine at the Art Institute. Barter was on the Indiana University campus last fall, and she spent time with WFIU's Yael Cassander, looking through the catalog for that exhibition, full of paintings about food.
And since we are coming up on Thanksgiving, I thought it was very appropriate that you do have so many plucked chickens and turkeys in this book, and also paintings about Thanksgiving itself. It's a far cry from Harnett's chicken hanging there on the door to Alice Neal's painting of a chicken in a kitchen sink that she sort of unceremoniously dumped there to thaw, I imagine. Using these pictures of chickens and various fowl as a launching pad, I'd like to talk about the history of Thanksgiving as codified by some of these American paintings.
Well, Thanksgiving is kind of a late holiday in a way. It wasn't formally made an American holiday until Abraham Lincoln made it a holiday after the Battle of Gettysburg. So
that would come as a surprise, I think, to a lot of people because they think it started way back there in the 17th
century. With the Pilgrims, yeah, no. The Pilgrims had Thanksgivings, plural, days of Thanksgivings that did not look anything like how we celebrate Thanksgiving. They fasted, for one thing, and spent the day in church and then came home and had a little something to eat. And the first Thanksgiving, as we all learned in school, was sort of based on festivities when the Indians came to Plymouth with some deer, 20 deer or something, and the colonists there put together vegetables and other things, and they all sat down and had a meal together. And that's referenced in an 18th century book. So Thanksgiving is sort of a new idea, and it was sort of based on the fall harvest in New England, where they usually did have something called Forefathers' Day, not Thanksgiving, which was to celebrate the history of New England, and it was usually in October, and the bringing in of the crops. And then it became increasingly commercial, and by 1920 it was about football. And Irma Bombeck famously said that it takes 18 hours to fix a Thanksgiving dinner. It takes 12 minutes to eat it. And it is no coincidence that halftime is 12 minutes long. And she was right. We've just commercialized Thanksgiving. Not as badly as Christmas, but almost the same way. And I think Alice Neal's painting of the capon thawing in the kitchen sink is really a great picture. First of all, she's thumbing her nose at pop art, where the surfaces are very slick and everything's perfect. This is a juicy picture with lots of impasto and paint, and it's visceral. And there's this dead bird in the sink. And everybody knows it. Any woman knows, anyway, that is exactly how Thanksgiving starts, with that bird draining in the sink.
This is an unpicturesque, unromanticized vision of Thanksgiving from the woman's perspective. Although it does make a really pretty great painting, and the design and the composition is fantastic, it is not Norman Rockwell.
No, it is not. It's sort of like, okay, here's this dead thing. What am I going to do with it?
And Alice Neal was quite an outrageous character from what I understand.
She was.
Well, did you manage then to, in fact, have the Norman Rockwell painting for this exhibition?
Oh, yes. Freedom from Want.
Can you talk about that one, Judy?
Yes. Norman Rockwell did a series of four paintings based on American freedoms in 1941. And it was based basically on an address by FDR, who was talking about world events and the unique place of Americans. And Freedom from Want was one of those. In other words, having enough to eat, never having to go hungry. And so Rockwell used this as a Thanksgiving scene. And it's sort of fascinating because there's Grandma and Grandpa, and the whole family is gathered around, and Grandma's bringing in this beautifully browned, you know, cook's kitchen type of of turkey to sit on the table. And yet the weird thing about the picture is all the rest of the table is sort of white with nothing on it to eat. There are some grapes or some nuts. I think there's a dish of celery.
Jell-O
salt
molds.
And pepper. Jell-O molds. Jell-O molds were very important in the 40s and 50s.
I think a wonderful contrast is provided by this Norman Rockwell painting, Freedom from Want, with a painting that was just about contemporaneous with it, and that is your famous painting at the Art Institute, Hopper's Nighthawks.
Yes.
We're seeing a whole different way of interacting around eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that painting?
Well, of course, Hopper is showing almost a post-depression or end-of-depression sort of topic. Diners became very popular, as were automats, as cheap places to get food after the Depression. But Hopper's also showing us an urban scene, whereas Rockwell is showing us a more of a domestic scene. Hopper's showing us a diner that operates all night long, and the Nighthawks are the people that hang out late at night, and they're in there having their coffee. And Hopper, a lot of people see loneliness in Hopper. I do not. I see aloneness in Hopper. And I think those are two very different ideas. And so I think Hopper's pictures are more about feeling solitude within a social arena. I find them very poetic in that sense.
Judith Barter talking about the 2013 exhibition she curated for the Art Institute of Chicago, her complete conversation with Yael Cassanders at wfiu.org/profiles. Coming up,
we don't need to raise a generation of beekeepers that, you know, after college start beekeeping, I mean, that's great. But we just want to raise a more knowledgeable generation. I mean, I personally will be beekeeping as long as I can because I love it.
Ellie Sims, president of Indiana University's Beekeeping Club. She talks about the emotional roller coaster that is working with bees. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Where are we doing this at? Right here? Back by the fryer. Yes, Chef. We're going to the fryer.
Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
This is where the magic happens.
The deep frying.
The deep fry. This is where the thousands and thousands of our farm-famous Parmesan and garlic chili fries come from.
I thought you were going to say thousands and thousands of calories.
Deep fat, lots of calories, but if done correctly, deep fat frying can actually be fairly healthy. It doesn't absorb a lot of oil and grease if you don't have a real thick batter. And if you do the appropriate steps so it doesn't absorb the oil, basically you're just immersing it into a really hot environment and steaming it from the inside out. So, we're going to start by making our batter. And you want to make your batter not too far in advance. No more really than an hour or so. So, starting with some all-purpose flour. We're going to add to this cornstarch, and the cornstarch makes things extra crisp and light. We're going to add a little bit of sugar for some sweetness, add some salt. If we wanted to, we could add any number of things to this. We could put some cayenne, we could put some chili powder, some sesame seeds, some sesame oil, things like that. I mean, this is just, like we like to do here, we like to take a really basic recipe, and then we build on that. And I think that's what all good cooks should do at home as well. So I'm just using my hand, mixing all my dry ingredients together. And then I have one beaten egg. Get really beat up together there. Some tempura recipes don't call for any egg, but this is just going to ensure that it's going to stick and stay together in the fryer. And then we're going to add some beer to our dry ingredients. That was about a cup of really ice-cold beer, nice and cold. If you don't have the beer, you could use soda water. And the consistency is like a little bit thicker than crepe batter, a little thinner than pancake batter. It's okay if you got a few clumps. I'm using my hands here just to make sure that, you know, I'm getting them pretty well. So it should coat your fingers when you come up out of the batter.
Chef Bob Adkins, the executive chef at Farm Bloomington, he gave a hint there to what we'll be tempura-ing up today. The conclusion of this recipe, just ahead. The American agriculture industry has a problem. Each year, fast-growing, high-tech food and agribusiness companies are adding more jobs than there are qualified college graduates to fill them. That's left the industry with an uncertain future. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
When Colorado State University student Aubrielle Jones tells her friends she's studying agriculture, she sometimes gets a puzzled look.
Oh, you're learning about corn, right? Oh, you're learning about how cows eat. Things like that.
But it's way more than that. Just check out her major.
My major is agricultural literacy. I have a minor in global and environmental sustainability, and then another minor in agricultural resource economics.
It's a mouthful. But it's a combination of degrees that likely sets Jones up for a pretty easy job hunt when she graduates in the spring. See, graduates with agricultural degrees are in high demand, and will be for the foreseeable future.
I mean, it's very encouraging. Yeah, most definitely. And I think it's amazing that those numbers are rising, and so that gives more opportunities.
A recent report from Purdue University and the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows there'll be close to 60,000 jobs opening up in ag and food sectors each year for the next 5 years. But here's the problem. There's not enough grads like Jones to fill them. The report projects about 2 open jobs for every qualified graduate.
Our students in animal science, some of them have 2 and 3 job offers when they leave.
Kevin Pond directs CSU's Department of Animal Science. He says part of the problem is perception. Young people just don't think of agriculture as a growing field or an area with sunny job prospects. Students, even at this land-grant university, are increasingly urban. Most don't come from a farm background.
The truth is, in animal science, it's 80% female, it's 90% urban, and our new minority is a white male from a rural background. Crazy to think.
There's still the stereotype of the farmer in manure-covered overalls driving an old tractor, Pond says. Helping prospective students see ag as a modern, potentially lucrative field of study is part of the school's sales pitch. The jobs opening up are highly skilled, and a lot of times they're at Fortune 500 companies. They're in marketing, food safety, plant science, and veterinary medicine.
It's no longer menial labor that is at a low salary. Their salaries are going up and up and up because of the scarcity.
Agriculture programs at land-grant universities are focusing on science in a bid to stay relevant, Pond says, even as it takes fewer people to run farms and ranches.
Well, if you have 1% of your population is feeding the other 99%, if we're relying on that pool to fill our classrooms, we're going to be a dying college.
I think recruitment is a problem.
Krista Harden is second in command for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She says private companies need to do a better job wooing students and working with public universities. And she says part of the problem in filling these jobs is where they are. Many recent college grads look to major cities for their first jobs, Harden says, not rural Illinois, for example.
Even our mega big agribusinesses are often in smaller cities and in rural locations, and the jobs they have may be out and a grain elevator or a buying point or a smaller city. And so how do you attract young people?
CSU senior Aubrielle Jones says she's already being recruited, but her passions are in local food and organic agriculture. So when food giants like Tyson or ConAgra come knocking?
Honestly, I feel like the businesses and industries that have come to me are ones that I'm not particularly interested in. They're mostly like the large ag industries and things like that.
That mismatch in values is part of what's leaving big food companies with vacant jobs, even as food remains a hot topic. Those same friends who think all she does is study corn, over the years at CSU, they've come around.
The thing that I've really noticed about my friends over the past couple of years is that they're becoming way more interested in the food that they're eating than they were at the beginning.
It'll take a lot more of those friends turning a casual interest in food into a degree in agricultural science to eventually fill the gap. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Stories like this one from around America's food and farming scenes posted at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Do you want to wear one of these? Or?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Ellie Sims has just handed me a beekeeping hat and mask. I struggle to fit it over top of my headphones, and then I have to wrap the string around my recording equipment and around my waist to secure the net.
This, I think, is inherently not comfortable.
Yeah. I am so used to it now.
But you have shorts on, so you're not worried about your legs or your feet?
No. And you're technically not supposed to wear red, but my Chiefs won last night, so.
I'm with her at the hives she helps manage at Indiana University's Hilltop Garden and Nature Center. Sims is the president of Indiana University's Beekeeping Club, but she doesn't consider herself an expert. She's only been working with bees for 3 years. In that time, though, she has experienced plenty of ups and downs.
I don't get intimidated about the bees anymore. Once you understand their behaviors, it's just like, oh, well, he's doing that now. I'll do a little bit more smoke. And I've been stung, and being stung is really not so bad. It's really not. So, like, one time I accidentally, you know, almost smushed a bee on the edge of a frame, and she panicked and stung me. And then another time I thought it was okay to not use smoke. Yeah, I cracked, I think it was this hive last year open, and it just like shot out right away and got me in the leg. And that was my first sting. I actually was like really excited. Like probably the only person to get excited by a sting. I was like, I'm a real beekeeper now. Like, yes. The wind just picked up. When I first got here, this was no problem. There we go. All right. This is the hardest part about beekeeping is the smoker, to be honest. Summer after freshman year, I was getting really bored of lifeguarding and wanted to kind of jazz it up. And so I Googled environmental volunteering and found beekeeper's assistant needed. And I was like, yeah, that looks weird. I'll try that. That looks fun. And I fell in love with it. So this hive's kind of struggling. They're not going to make it through winter because they don't have, number one, they don't have enough numbers. And number two, the honey stores are super weak.
Gosh, so you're just planning on total failure for this hive.
Yeah.
That is so sad. Are you devastated?
Beekeeping is a soap opera, I've learned. And honestly, I used to get really upset and get really emotional about it, but now it's just like, okay, we don't need to raise a generation of beekeepers that, you know, after college start beekeeping. I mean, that's great. But we just want to raise a more knowledgeable generation that kind of understands this issue. I mean, I personally will be beekeeping as long as I can because I love it. Oh, I just smushed one. Oh, God, that's sad. And now he's going. See him wiggling the tail? The other guy? Yeah. Okay, that was sad. All right. I'm sorry.
A surprisingly emotional moment there with Ellie Sims. We have a picture of her with her failing hives at eartheats.org.
All right, so
back now with Chef Bob at the fryer.
We've got our green beans here, nice, fresh out of the garden green beans. We're going to toss them in a little bit of flour or cornstarch and drop them right down on the batter. Give them a quick toss. Whoa, it's all right. Frying is usually messy. I think that's why people go out to restaurants for fried foods, because it is. It's greasy and it's messy. Okay, 350 degree fat. Just going to drop these in one by one. You don't want them to clump together in the fryer. And you can see they've got this beautiful light brown batter on them, but you can still see a little bit of the green. So now out of the oil, and then we're going to just put them onto a plate or into a bowl. Line with a little bit of paper towel, soak up any extra fat or grease, and then we'll just dust a little bit of kosher salt right over that, and then dip them in whatever you want.
Well, I sure do love those green beans, but I don't like them from a can.
Other things we've fried up: green tomatoes, of course, acorn squash, squash blossoms stuffed with cheese and anchovies. Those were good. Dipping sauce ideas as well at eartheats.org.
I'm eating green beans in my dreams. There's nothing in the whole wide world that can make me stop thinking about green beans.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good to have been with you today. I'm Annie Corrigan.